Pick Podcast, Picks and Perspective with Chris Johnson.
There we go.
There he is. Thank you so much for sending the album over, man. I've listened to it probably like three, going on four times now. It's really enjoyable.
Right on. I'm glad you dig it.
Man, the tone.
I'm taking a track off of it. I've got like 12 on there now, or 11. I'm just going to put 10.
Oh, okay. Can you tell me which one you're taking off? Or
it's all right.
Okay.
It doesn't kind of flow with the record. It was one of those ones that I just wrote myself on the keyboards and laid it down and played everything too. And it was more of an idea. I think it'll do fine with that.
Okay. I mean, you cover a lot of ground on this thing. That's the interest. I mean, you kind of do on the first record too. You cover a lot of ground, but like this one, it definitely feels like even more of a cohesive record, you know, from start to finish. I feel like there's more complete thoughts. There's more like, there's just more of you, you know?
Thanks. The last one I worked a lot with, I had a guitar player and it was everybody in the studio all day, all night kind of thing. And it's just, you get too many people in there. It just kind of takes away from the, you know, we laid all the basic tracks down. Everybody was four on the floor. You know, this one, I went to like two different drummers. I like the feel of the first thing, but I wanted more of a finesse kind of drummer for some of the songs. And so, I've got two drummers on this thing. So
you track it all out there in Nashville?
I track everything out there. Yeah. I'll go and write three or four or five songs and then decide on which ones I'm going to keep. And we'll work for probably 3 weeks on, you know, three or four songs and you just get them nailed. Mm-hmm. Then I'll take about a 2 month break, go back, do the next thing, you know, touch up what I want to, you know, touch up. And then I went back and really replayed all the bass except for the fretless parts. We wanted a consistent bass sound throughout. Now I was using different basses on everything. It was kind of weird because I had been playing, you know, I think we talked about it yesterday a little bit, where I was playing guitar for, you know, learning to play again. And, you know, it's not a big stack of Marshalls anymore. It's these small box. My little box 15 AC hand-wired 15 sounds better than anything I got.
It's great.
You know, man. Just a little with a 25 watt, you know, your standard greenback in it. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not sure what it has in it, dude. We had like a dual mono setup so we could, you know, turn different amps on. I've also got one of those JD8 switching things so I can turn any amp on I want in a room.
Oh, that's awesome.
Some of the stuff is just straight through a Marshall but real clean, you know, that is clean. I like the clean style of Marshalls and you get a little gain from a couple of pedals, but I only use one pedal at a time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a whole like two big setups, but it's like I only use just one pedal for it, just kind of brings out the whole it's got a little 1176 in it, you know, the little version of it.
Is that kind of like in the mindset of like having a short signal chain, ultimately like having purest tone possible type of thing? Is that kind of your mindset around it?
Yeah, even though I think you're probably losing a little bit with the, you know, now they have the pre-buffers, but all of my pedals are buffered anyway. So, but if you put too many buffers on there, you know, that's why I kind of like just using one or two pedals at a time, you know.
Yeah.
And it just depends on what, you know, if you're going for, there's two types of gains, I like to say. There's the real transparent gain where it's just, I like to get the speaker broken up before I even go in anyway. And then from there, just kind of put a little, like, whatever expression. I think those are what they are expression pedals, not, you know, you know what I'm saying? It's not like the pedal makes your whole sound. I'm more the guy that, you know, plugs in, and that's your, you know, it's a guitar into the amp kind of sound.
But yeah, so it's just enhancing a little bit.
Correct.
Yeah. Giving you a little bit more juice to sing with, you know?
Right. You know, if you need a chorus on a part, you can always put a chorus on. If you need a flanger on some of the stuff, we used, I used like a small stone, and, you know, like an old one on this one that was really cool.
What was it? I think on the first song.
Yeah.
I was saying, I think it might be, I think it's track 11. What is,
what do you want?
What do you want? What is, there's a specific effect on that. I don't know what it is. It's very, very, like I've heard it somewhere else. I was trying to figure out what it was. Do you remember what you used on that?
For the main chorus or what part?
Yeah, I think it's,
there's a lot of acoustic on this record too. So
that's true.
The acoustic were the underbelly. And then we wanted to, you know, I'd always have a clean guitar going into like a dual 12, 40. I've got a dual 12, 40 old Fender. That really kind of rips, you know. It's got that you got to have that Fender tone, man. I'm really just, you know, I used a bunch of smaller amps on this, so I think you get a bigger and better tone from it, you know, than just running everything. But there, during the choruses, there's a huge Marshall on there that we played, and that's all the SGs and stuff. But all the rest, you know, the majority of the stuff's Tele.
Is there a keyboard on that track? Maybe that's what I'm thinking it is.
Yeah, it's
that's what it is.
It's also like a reverse reverb that's going on over the vocals.
Okay. Oh, cool. No wonder. Okay. Yeah. What a great, you have such a, I like what I think is interesting about listening to this record, honestly, is that, and knowing you for, you know, off and on for 10 years or more, like it's, I hear all these beautiful things that are very much Rex Brown, very much from your experience as a person and as a musician. And right. So it's like one part is your influence and like, and one part is just like who you are. And they're just really beautifully mixed on this record. And like the tones, like I love the drum tones, like just the way the drums sound and how they connect with the bass. It's just, feels very classic to me. It feels very warm and inviting.
It's more loose, and even though it's a tight, you know, look, I'm going to, you know, you take the void from the farm as far as you can take them, but you're still going to have a little bit of farm in there.
That's right.
So I'd like to take that aggressiveness, and I like, dude, parts have to be tight, but they have to be human, you know? So what we did was, is that my producer's wife had gone out of town. So we took all the furniture out of the very top and put a snake up there, and you see, and it's a real bright sounding, you know, it's all, hardwood floors and like kind of tile on the wall, so you get that kind of effect, and that's really what I needed for the drums. In fact, that's where we got that really, because down in the studio when you get it real closed in, it just sounds like it's, you know, upstairs we could let it breathe, but also just compress the shit out of it. You know, I'm a real fan of just compressing the fuck out of stuff. And but putting a lot of gain on it, so, you know, so it can breathe, you know.
Yeah and have its own place sit
in
the mix, right?
In the mix.
Yeah,
it was a whole thing. And I also had to use some different guys this time for mastering, which I think has made all the difference in the world.
Really? Who's that? Who'd you use?
Sterling Sound.
Okay.
The guys that did the first, you know, did the Pantera records, but they did them, you know. I used an engineer that works for the head honcho, Ted Jensen, that did all the Pantera stuff.
Cool. Well, that's awesome, man.
I thought he did an amazing job of it.
Yeah, it sounds so top notch. I mean, I expect that, but at the same time, I'm always just like kind of just going into new projects and new albums that people pass to me with a fresh mind as possible. You know, you don't know what you're going to get necessarily. I knew it would be, you know, in this zone, but I don't know. It's exceeded my expectations, you know, and on a lot of levels.
Thanks.
songwriting wise, and the way your voice sounds.
I know you're not kissing ass at this, sir. You know, we've always had that point of view. You know, that's long gone. I appreciate it. It's one of those records that it's, I want to say introspective because I think of the lyrics. And also because a lot of these things just started coming to me, you know, I was like, where did that one go? You know, and then I go back in my tape and like my phone and I've got like a million riffs in here and I go, that's 2002, 2003, you know, but you gotta like, I won't update this new thing until I update all of my recordings on here. It's crazy. So anyway, yeah, it's just, man, it's like things were just, when they start flying out, I never kind of experienced that before, you know, where things just started pen to paper, you know, like the letter and this song especially. I think I was listening, I go, man, I really want to use a cadence that kind of sounds like this. So I listened to a certain track and then just stop the second line of a verse. Mm. And then from there, it would just kind of, there you go. There's where you go off on, you know? And I listen to all kinds of crazy shit too.
I assume, was that song, The Letter, is that for Vinny? Or is that?
No. That was about a couple of friends. What had happened, we were in the middle of doing Ordinary Life. And one friend I'd known, I just found out the day before that he had cancer and I couldn't make his funeral. And then no more than, you know, somebody called me and told me about what, you know, I called them back and they said, oh, by the way, you know, a real kind of a father figure to me passed away. So he had two guys in one day. And I'm sure that Vinny is part of that process when I wrote it, because I was really down and just, you know, you lose two people in one day, you know.
It's big.
But it's also relevant now because we're losing thousands a day.
So many.
You know, so we might release. Look, nobody listens to the last track on a record unless you're one of those buffs that likes to listen to the whole record, right? Most That's kids me. These days just flip through. That's me too. I got to hear like every fucking song or, you know, then it won't get my seal of approval. But most kids are just flying through whatever new videos you put up. So I plan on shooting a video for this whole record.
Awesome. You know? Yeah.
So that way they have to, you know, they're going to have to listen to it, you know, because I found out on that first record that, you know, we only had hits off the ones that we had a video to or a lyric video to or whatever. So
wow.
I think we might put the letter first in this. I'm not sure. We'll see. But that might come before Christmas. And I'm heading to Nashville 1st of December. I've got a film crew and a bus picking me up. I refuse to fly, man. I'm just not going to catch the shit.
Yeah,
I'm just not going to. And I'll still have to be, you know, precautious on that. But management has, we've got tests that we can do on the bus, which is cool.
That's great.
Very nice. They put some money down and bought a whole bunch of test kits and it's going to be cool.
Awesome. Well, that's the new way now. We just got to
find beforehand. Yeah. If you're going to be in a big crowd, you need to, everybody's got to test before they jump on a bus and do the whole protocol, you know? Yep.
And regular tests if you're going to be prolonged with them as people split off and come back to the group, you know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Coming and going, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's awesome, man. I mean, since we last talked, like, we lost EVH, and I just wanted
to
check in with you and see how you're feeling, because I know that he was a good friend to the band, and I don't know, you know?
Every day, you know, I knew Eddie, but I didn't know. I mean, like, we weren't on a texting basis.
Sure.
You know, we just kind of show up, meet him here, wherever. what do you say about somebody that invented every, I mean, there wouldn't be bands possible today with rock and roll without Eddie Van Halen.
That's right. You know,
the way, or that band in general, you know, for my generation, of how they put it together and just made it, you know, is that party rock band, but it's also so brilliantly put together, you know. Mm-hmm. That was another one of those main Lifetime bands. And I want to say, you know, that hopefully Pantera down the line, you know, in 10 years can be remembered kind of that way. But, you know, we had kind of the party element and, you know, try to make everybody feel good, even if Phil was singing about all kinds of crazy shit.
I think you did a good job at that. It was still,
you know, that that's just because of growing up with, you know, I had two brothers in the band that did the same thing. They just mm-hmm. wanted to be the Van Halen brothers, and they were batshit crazy like those boys were. And it was, you know, we started partying young, you know, we really did. But we honed our craft, and that came first. And I think that the same goes for Eddie. You know, him, you know, like he even, I'll quote him, you know, there's only three really good guitar builders ever. That was, you know, him, Leo, and Les, you mm-hmm. know, and he was friends with both of them. Mm-hmm. Because he took all the elements out of a Les Paul and put it into a Strat, you know, and made the best of both worlds. And it's one of those things that I think that he doesn't get enough credit for, you know. He flipped everybody on their fucking head when that first record came out. Man, I remember it was like 70, it's middle 77 or maybe in the fall. And that record dropped, and I was sitting in the back with friends, smoking a joint. I must have been 13, you know, and jumping in the back of a Gran Torino, and he had 6x9s in the back, and listening to Eruption right off the fucking bat. I mean, just Running with the Devil and into Eruption, right? Mm-hmm. And it just that. You know, the train, I'll never forget that rumble that was in the car, you mm-hmm. know, and then your ears were just there. Nobody was doing, and to this day, nobody's doing that shit.
No,
you know,
it can't be replicated, man. That's the interesting thing about when you got originals like that, it takes somebody like you guys, like Pantera. Like, it's interesting because, in some ways, yeah. On the surface, you wouldn't say, you know, if you took a passing look, you'd be like, oh, Pantera is not necessarily an Eddie Van Halen or a Van Halen inspired band exactly, you know, like not verbatim, right? Because it's much heavier, the subject content's different. But as you get to know both of them and you unwind it a little bit, you're like, oh, wait, no,
Dime, they really are.
Dime yeah, really
how,
took
how close, yeah.
You know, very close approach to what Eddie was doing and gave it his flair. And you guys,
I'll tell you what, man, we could, you know, we played in clubs, six nights a week, three sets a night, you know, and we had to cover everything that was popular in the day. And so we would go back and, you know, every crowd, even if you still play it today, if you covered a Van Halen track and did it right, you know, which I wish we did. We have a track somewhere.
Really? Anyway, you guys covered it?
Yeah, I just remembered it too. And it might be it might be one of the very last tracks we haven't put out.
Wow. That'd be really cool.
I'm trying to think of what it is, but I won't spare anything else other than saying we used to play an awfully mean fucking Van Halen. It was just trying to, you know, a singer trying to do all those, you know, trying to be Dave with another
Dave is subject. Out of this world, man.
The first singer we had in Pantera was, you know, he had that whole, you know, Roth thing, you know, but it was very, it didn't last very long, you know.
Right, right. It reminded me more of a kind of like a Rat type of, I don't know. I listened to those early records a little bit, you know, but it's like obviously a different vibe back then. It was like for the times, you know.
Yeah, that was just because we had the access to go into a studio and write and, you know, put records out with terrible covers on them, and they'll never see the light of day. So,
in those early days, did you guys record like at Dime's place? Did his parents or his dad have a studio? Is that where you guys recorded?
His dad was an engineer, at a studio, but the only place in Dallas really. And, I remember us being, you know, teenagers, like, you know, I guess I was 15 and Dime's about 13, and we used to, and this was before I even joined their band. I had had my own band on the side called Neck and the Brewheads. And we played a bunch of Cream. We played a bunch of Stones. We played a bunch of Zeppelin and, or what we could get through with just a three piece. Nice. And we played all the keg parties in town but anyway, I was still good friends with Vinny, because he was in the he's the drummer in the jazz band at the first period of class in high school. And of course I had known of those guys. They had the only PA in town. I used to borrow it. And the good days, man. It's go back and look, when something like this, like Eddie dies, you go back and you remember all when you're a kid growing up and all the influences it had on you and how the impact it really made. So it's like, you know, there's a ton of stuff I need to be doing, but I just find myself going back and watching stuff I haven't seen, you know, of Van Halen, because after a certain point I just, you know, jumped off the boat. I didn't know if they were touring, or, you know, you didn't know what singer was going to be in the band or anything like that. So, you know, I was a diehard fan all the way through. I even liked the Van Hagar days, you know.
Me too.
You know, it's crazy. I think they had more number one hits with Sammy than they did with Roth. So
that's crazy.
but it's just, you know, it brought back memories. Going back to when we were in the studio as kids, we would watch all the blues guys come through, or any great, Johnny Paycheck used to come through there, the dad had written a song with. So, you know, like, as kids going, how the fuck they get that sound, you know? So we grew up in a studio, you know, really, literally.
There's a lot to be learned just by being there next to people doing the thing that you don't necessarily, you know, you're just shown it. There's an example in front of you the whole time. Yeah, right?
There was a couch in front of the board. And of course there was a big, you know, like a huge room in the Middle East in this warehouse district. And it was owned by, what was the name? United Artists Records. I can't remember. But anyway, the dad was an engineer for a while. And then he produced us, and, you know, that's a very long story. But anyway, Eddie will be missed dearly.
Sure will. Did you mention, I thought you mentioned last time we talked, did you say something in the very early days about Pantera being straight edge in the beginning? Like there was no drinking, no smoking, nothing in the early, early days when you first got together?
Yeah.
How long did that last?
About 3 months. You know, I walked in with the six pack of lowbrows, 17, and they'd actually call me. I'd been at rehearsal, and I thought Dom was calling about the PA, and he wanted it back. It was like 11 at night, and they said, "You want to come to the studio and play on some tracks?" And I'm like, "Sure." I'd just been to rehearsal, been playing for 3 hours. You know, I was pretty hot, warmed up. You know. And so I went down and I don't remember punching in. I just remember them showing me the track and put my own stamp on it. And about a week later, I got a call that they kicked the bass player out and wanted me to join the band. And my other two guys, it was the last year of high school. So they were going to go, to college, and I'd gotten a scholarship, but to the NSTU, North Texas State. And so anyway, they said, "Well, look, you can't drink or smoke and all this shit," because their dad, another dad, was, even though he was partied on the side, he just didn't tell his kids. So I walked in with a cigarette in one mouth and, you know, low and brown in the other, and just to be an asshole, I guess, you know. Then after that, I, you know, Dom, yeah, we started we had a wiener, you know, kind of start with the weed, you know, go into the drinking later on. Yeah, I'll never forget the first time I got him fucked up on Jack. It was, yeah.
That's funny. Dom didn't really smoke that much, did he? Like, he smoked a little bit.
He's a bigger smoker than I was back.
Well, in the early days, he was.
Once he got into it. Okay. Once he got into it, that's how I got the name Dimebag. He always had weed on him.
It's interesting because I think in the later years, I it seemed like he didn't smoke as much. He was just a drinker more, right? Like, he's still kind of advocate for weed.
The one thing that we found was that weed, after you drank a bottle of whiskey, it would fuck your whole whiskey buzz up. You know what I'm saying? So maybe smoke, you know, we got off the bus and get rolling. You know, just get the day straight, try to get some of the fur off from the night before. And then, and then once the whiskey set in, you know, between the four of us, we were drinking, you know, at least six bottles of booze a night easily.
Wow.
You know, and that's before that was just meeting people and playing shows. So,
Man.
So when you're on stage, you can't have it all the way up to here. So you got to throw it up, then you have to drink more to, you know, get it back. So
that's a real deal. That's a real deal.
And it ruined my pancreas. Thank you.
Oof. Thanks, alcohol. No, thanks.
Yeah, no more, baby.
No more.
No more.
No. That time came and went. It's interesting because, you know, a lot of artists through the years obviously get a lot of inspiration and find their kind of groove through a little bit of pot, a little bit of alcohol, maybe a little blow on the side or whatever. And they kind of go down that path for a while and they're able to kind of maintain it for a while. But then if they're to stick around, you know, it's inevitable that it has to kind of go away. You have to clean it up a little bit and find what is manageable and sustainable.
I think it works for a period of time and you get really, you know, but then it becomes a problem where you need it. And that's when you have the problem, you know, when you start having to have it, that's not normal, you know,
right.
Or something just to get you through or, you know, something like that. And that's when you got to stop and take a look, you know. Okay, let's just cool back a little bit, or, you know, and then eventually over time, that's kind of what we all did. I mean, I remember towards the end, before, you know, Daryl passed, he would just get off the road and see how long he could stay sober, you know, which sometimes would last, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, and then, you know, he would let it ride all the way into the next tour.
Mm.
But you got to remember, we were always fucking on the road. So
that's right.
But towards the end, he was watching, you know, watching what he was doing, or at least trying, I think.
You feel like you guys, what's that?
I just think he had too much stuff on his shoulders towards the end. Mm. You know, I just think he was ready to just take a break. Like, I mean, I was already there and I'd told them, you know, look, I've got small kids. We've got to slow down, or, you know, we've been gone just, you know, 12 years seemed like 30, you know, within the blink of an eye. And, you know, because we were constantly just nonstop touring. You got to add that, you know, other 8 before that.
Right. And
it was just, Vinny just wanted to stay on the road nonstop. And, you know, for everybody's sanity, we needed a serious, serious break.
Do you feel like you guys, when in the heyday, like before the end started coming, do you feel like you guys toured well together? You guys do fine as far as like relationships on the road and stuff, or was there tension in the band?
In fact, there was a little bit of tension after, you know, filling the H word, you know, cause none of us did that. I never have in my life. We weren't, you know, those guys, and I wasn't either being in the blow or anything like that. So it was the alcohol, but it was catching up, you know. You could feel it, you know. In fact, I threw myself into rehab in 2003 just to figure out why, you know. And once you leave with all that information, it's a little bit overwhelming, you know, picture kind of thing. But then it, you know, then you, you know, you'd fall and you pick yourself up again and fall and pick yourself up again. That's, and then finally you just say, fuck it. You win.
Yeah. The, you know, new, high, the new high becomes like being sober, you know, that like, cause you get to a point where like that the trouble that, that the alcohol causes is not worth it. Right. Like, and it's not worth the health, you know, risks.
Well, mine was that. More. Yeah. I mean, it got to the point where I would, you know, it's like, people were worried about me, you know, like, and I didn't see that. I mean, I knew that I had something horrible with my gut. I went to all kinds of doctors in LA, couldn't find anybody. I finally got lucky and found someone that knew what I had. I mean, you know, at the same time, doctors were giving me, you know, heavy duty sedatives to help with this pain that I had. When all they had to do was go and just give me an MRI, I could see that my pancreas was full of stones, you know, and that happens between guys between the age of 38 and 45. So around the end of 2007, or really, I quit drinking in 2007 completely. I mean, like for 3 years, I was on the road with down, nothing to drink. And that's, I was still having, that's when it really, really started buckling me. And if I would have added alcohol, it might have killed me. You never know.
Right, right. You know?
So I couldn't just keep up with that pace anymore, even though those crazy bastards, you know, they were nuts.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're still here, man. It makes me really happy, especially listening to this record. That's like part of the joy of listening to the record, man, is going, my boy Rex is still here. He's still doing this thing.
And, I know. I'm just not going to go away. I've got too much to say. And the more we're losing people and stuff like that, you got to take every day and live it like it's your last, you know? So
that's right. That's right. It's that kind of, when I teach yoga, it's kind of the mantra of like, stay awake, you know, don't go to sleep. Like, we got to stay awake for ourselves and for each other in relationship. And that's what I feel like, that's how we're going to move forward, is to stay awake and be of service to each other. You know, if we fall asleep, then, and we just kind of go on autopilot, then things just kind of, they'll keep going the way they've gone, you know?
Yeah. But, I did that for a while, you know, probably 2011, 12, I kind of went through that thing where I was just on autopilot, you know, I just had the surgery and, you know, trying to get back to normal. And just, I hate those phases when you go through life and you're on autopilot, you know, and you look back and you go, oh shit, you know? It is life, you know, it is what it is. You know, I still smoke great medical marijuana, you know, that helps me tremendously with the aches and pains down here, and absolutely. And gets me high for about 10 minutes. And after that, you know, I just have a little, you know, residue, but I just don't like getting fucking stupid fucked up where you can't talk anymore. You know,
same. Yeah. I enjoy, I enjoy herb. I enjoy a beer every once in a while. I don't really drink, but
either you drink or you're not, you know, once too many thousand, I'm not.
Yeah. I'm not.
So you got lucky there, my friend.
I really did, because my grandfather was a drinker, and so I could have, you know, had that very thing. Easy. But no, it's the weed thing definitely has its claws in me a little bit, because I love the smell, and it's mostly a benign thing. As long as I don't abuse it and don't overuse it, I feel great about it, you know, because
I smoke low grade THC but high grade CBD with it. And I just, man, I felt it just made a world of difference on my psyche.
That's great. You know, is that like dad grass stuff?
No, it's grown that way here in New Mexico. I've got a card I can just go down and a place of order on my whatever. You place an order through the internet and you just go pick it up like just 13 minutes down the road.
That's great.
And it's not any, you know, You never know what you're going to get off the street. And I don't like dealing with street fucking people. And we never have. Because we always, you know, I've never had to buy fucking weed or anything in my fucking life. I mean, I did way back in the day, but you know, those days are those stealing days are way over too. Working out of a photo mat, selling acid. I mean, come on. when you're 17 years old, you know.
Oh, I've been working since I was.
I've been working since I was 12. So yeah, I worked in a photo mat, dude. It was fucking great. The ideal place. People pull up, put their film off, right? And you'd have the hippies back behind. We'd pass a joint through. You just got to open this one on the other side. It was the perfect job.
Oh,
you
man.
Know, one of those kiosk jobs in Arlington, Texas.
You deal weed and acid out of there?
I would deal weed and fucking acid and all kind of, you know, you get those beanies that, you know, the little, you know, you get them for 50 cents or you get them for like 20, like a quarter, you know, and then you just sell them for $2 a fucking pill, you know.
Right.
Put them in one of the little pouches. It's totally legal.
Back in the day.
I'd talk about it in my book. It's pretty hilarious. The shit I got away with back then.
I used to deliver pizza in my small town, and being the pizza delivery guy in a small town, have a bunch of weed in with my cars with eights all divvied up. And, hey, here's your pizza. Oh, what's up, Josh? How's it going? Yeah, you want an eighth too? All right. No problem.
Yeah. Anybody else you want to call? Right. Exactly.
Exactly.
But those are, you know, you didn't want to get caught. That's for damn sure.
No, I don't do that.
Thank God I never did. Never did. My mom found a quarter pound of fucking in the glove box one time. She took it away. I said, Mom, you don't know who I'm dealing with here. If I don't pay that money back, these people, they're going to break my knees, you know, make up a big story like that. But, and I got rid of doing that, you know.
Yeah.
And then the band really started kicking in. So I was good.
Man, all you had to do back in the day, or anytime, you just say, hey, anybody got any weed? And I'm sure the whole crowd just tossed.
Oh, yeah. You'd fill up a cigarette pack full of, I mean, this is all a crutch. You know, I mean, that's it. I got to quit fucking smoking. It's, I'm down to a lot, you know, down a pack a day, but still, it sucks. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yeah, it's like filling up a pack of smokes and, you know, rolling as many pinners as you could. Get to school early, you know, which I had to, and go to the front of the house, and everybody, you know, that was cool knew. I pretty much sold the jocks and the fucking, you know, the academics. See, they were a couple of years older, and hung out with that crowd and the band crowd and, you know, choir crowd or whatever, you know. So, yeah, now you had to make money, you know.
That's right. It's classic. That's the way to go. I mean, it's like when you're,
and people are going to look at this and go, what is this guy fucking talking about? He's a dope dealer. You know, he's just so unpolitically correct.
Oh man. It's different times, man. It's just the way it is. And pot.
I don't judge anybody else. So don't judge me. Thank you.
Yeah. Not going to do it, man. That's awesome. What do you got, coming up? Like you said, you're going to go back out and do more recording out in Nashville. Is that on the horizon, you said, or?
No, I think we're done. A couple of fix up. I'm going to go to the studio and just, there's just a couple of things that are killing me. And you know, my producer's like, dude, you're going to ruin it. You know, just leave it.
Mm.
And I'm like, let's see if we can just fix one word here. You know,
sure.
It's just all in, dude, I'm a perfectionist. You know, it's like, I've been doing this for my entire life since I was 17. So 40 years of it, you know? No.
Yeah.
39.
That's a life well lived, man. You've done a lot. I mean, was that like 9 albums or more with Pantera, or like total? Like, I think there's, including those early records.
And then a
couple of records with Down.
When I moved to, after Dime got murdered, I went to LA and played on I'll say 50 records. In fact, one came up this morning. I had played on something, but I had to use a fake name because I was still under contract with Elektra. So I just, my friend had a studio, and then we worked out at Ocean Way, the big studio out there off of Sunset, for all the big gigs. And I just, it was fun. I played on some big records. But I just couldn't use my name.
That's great, though. I mean, it's good that you got to do that, you know?
Yeah, but it really is, because I learned a lot about the craft, you know, and that's also with this, you know, pulling out the fretless, hey, and you hadn't played a fretless in a long time. Ooh. You get away with it on one track, but, you know, there's 8 tracks with fretless on this record, you know?
Wow.
So I was like, okay, now it's time to go practice for a week. And I did that while I was, you know, while I was recording. I didn't waste anybody's time. I just do it on my spare time and sit with an amp or headphones or whatever I needed to do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was my whole focus. Well, you focus so much heavily on the guitars. Why don't we focus on the bass on this one? And so I think it's a much more rounded me. Mm-hmm. You know, everything that we did is much more rounded. Plus, I have an extraordinary keyboard player, plays everything from, you know, a lot of the stuff that you hear, the glistening stuff is from just an old Dan Electro slide, you know, like lap steel.
Oh, really?
And we just put it through my amps, and it sounds fucking godly.
I was going to ask you if you're playing the slide guitar on the leads on that, or if that's a lap steel.
That's a lap steel. And I played on like one track. Misunderstanding the parts in the middle, you know, in between where the verses are, like the intros and stuff like that.
Nice.
A lot of fun. Yeah, but dude, that's another thing. You gotta sit and just, if you're not used to, you just gotta sit and, you know, just, man, I've learned that. You know, I've always played so fucking heavy and tight. I just found the easier I play, the easier it is to kind of get the notes across, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the foundation, this whole record was my old black telly I sent you yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
And then for the, some of the meteor parts, I used Les Paul in the middle position. And then over the top, I bought this really just fucking killer Firebird, man. I love it. And it has those mini humbuckers on it. So we tried to get it where it was just the point of breakup and still have that clean, you know. We just ran it through the rig, you know, sure. and it came out sounding like it did. But that's, you know, there's your layer of guitars. That's all you need.
Those are 3 distinct voices. You got your Les Paul, the one with the P90s, or were you using the one with the Hummers?
I used the ones with the P90s in it. I've got like an L5 Ronnie Wood, you know, the one that it doesn't have the they only made 50 of these things. I got a double 007. So anyway, it's a pretty clean guitar. It just has the burst buckers in them. But it we use that for a lot of leads. It smokes. Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah. The Tele sound, Les Paul sound, and mini hum on the Firebird.
That's all you need, really.
That's really great.
I can't think of anything else.
Yeah. For what you're up to and the way you're stacking tones, like it just works so perfectly. It's a great harmony you've made, with just the way it feels on the ears, you know?
Thanks. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want that big sound to it, you know, like you're hawking up a Luge. And that's what putting too many tracks, like the first record, you know, like say Crossing Lines or something like that, where I just put too many guitars. It was like, you know, 64 fucking it to do. You need just 2, you know, one either side, you're solid.
Sure.
So that's why I just decided, you know, let's go with these smaller amps. And during the process of that, SR was having a sale, and they really give me some great prices on stuff, and they all come with road cases. So I found this Ampeg reverberator, whatever the
fuck that is. Reverb rocket or
They said it was a reverb rocket because that's basically the one with the 12. This one had 2 12s in it, 65 watts, and then it had a clean and a distorted channel. And it sounded like one of those jazz chorus ones with it clean, you know, especially if you're in a little bit of you know, I rent some stuff into the effects return, send and return. And just a little bit of chorus, you know. The distortion channel was just insane. And I got this for like $300, dude, and it didn't have a nick on it. And I was just like, well, hell, you can put that off stage in the ISO box, you got the best of all worlds, you know?
Heck yeah.
So there you go. But I've got a bunch of Friedmans coming and
he makes great stuff.
Sorry, let me turn this off.
It's all good.
I've never seen one since like that, or hadn't seen one before. Ampey made some really, really good stuff.
They sure did.
I remember going to Seymour and used to hang with the senior vice president. He had an old Ampeg B4. Dude, brain fart, Rex. Why would you have to do that right in the middle of this? He's over at Fender now, the senior VP.
And I was
kind of doing they were doing a prototype bass that I never found. They flew me out there several times and just nothing. So. I'll tell you about the other big thing coming up on the next version when we get a little bit closer. Yeah, but I am going out to Nashville for Gibson. So
yeah, for the bass, right?
we have something huge coming out, and I can't spill the beans just yet.
That's exciting, though, man.
It's going to be nuts.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing what you guys come up with. You've always made cool basses, man. When you were at Spectre, when you did stuff with Warwick, man, you've always done cool stuff, and you always played. You had that really cool, that old Charvel. You had an old white Charvel, was that right?
Yeah, it was painted. Well, that was a Jackson.
Oh, it was a Jackson.
And then I had a Jackson 5-string. It was a hunk of shit. but that old blue Charvel. I mean, we played it until the frets came off of it, you know, and it sat, we didn't, you know, it sat in a case for years in my garage, and somebody, a big time collector, came and asked me what I had. And I said, well, I've got this and this, and they're just collecting dust. You know what I'm saying? If I got something that's just sitting around, nobody's playing, they need to be played, you know, so you do what you got to do.
No, that's great, though.
I would probably never pick those things up again in my life. So, you know, no reason hanging on to them. I mean, yeah. I've got so many. As my assistant, I've got so many fucking guitars. I just bought me. Oh, they bought me a brand new. Well, it's not a brand new. It's a 64 Gretsch double cut. The 6122. Which I'm really jazzed about, because I don't have anything from like my birthday, you know, like the year I was born. So
is that a Semihalo?
Yeah, but it's it's Semihalo, but it has the it's painted on there, so it's hollow, but it doesn't have the actual holes.
Oh, got it. So it's painted F holes, but it's still chambered. Got it.
Yep.
That's super cool.
I can't wait to get that. With a killer bass on it. That's the one thing I didn't have. I didn't have a really good Gretsch, you know, and I could definitely use it on some stuff.
That's another distinct sound too. Has it got Filtertrons on it?
It's got the old one in the bridge. It's got the, in the neck, it's got the Powertron and the Filtertron in the bridge.
Cool. Yeah, you got best of both worlds right there too.
I know. That's awesome. I can't wait. And I got a steel on it.
Really?
Sitting in the back of Chicago Music Exchange. I just, it had been in my wish list or whatever I put aside, you know, and I couldn't believe they had to dig it out of all kinds of stuff. And I call him buddy, Joel over there, and he's got his own band. I can't remember that name of his band either. Goddamn. you know, some things you remember, like I can't remember Thursday of last week. So, but I can remember all those years back.
Right.
You know, it's crazy.
It's a deeper imprint.
But anyway, Joe pulled it out and he goes, man, I can't believe we've had this sitting here. And anyway, so it's just probably one of the best Gretsches you can possibly own for that year, you know?
That's cool. That's one of the best shops, man. Chicago Music Exchange. They're really good guys.
Yeah.
Good shot.
You know, they own Reverb, so you know it's they're not doing bad.
No, they're doing great. Reverb's great. I enjoy I spend too much time on that site.
The advent of Reverb is just that's really where I went, you know, crazy with the pedal thing. You know, I would call like, you know, whoever these pedal makers were and say, you know, I'd really like to check out your pedal. Do you mind? I'll send it back. And I did send a lot of stuff back that I didn't use.
Did you ever use any dark glass stuff for bass?
No.
No?
I don't. There's all kinds of stuff you can run the bass through now. Dark glass? BK7s?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I did some of that. In fact, I have some of their tone pots too for basses. In fact, I've got a head in there. Yeah, yeah, I have used them. I thought you were saying Earthquaker. I don't know why I put those two together.
That's right. Now, dark glass seems to be like the modern kind of go-to pedal and preamp and everything, like for a lot of bass players these days. So I'm just curious if you
they are. I think they're good for what they are. You know, all my stuff's pretty hot rodded as it is, and I can get the game that I need, and I still use my Sans amp stuff. Mm. You know, and that's what I've always used. You know, the Sans amp, you cannot beat their product. You know, you just can't.
Agreed. So, yeah, a lot of people have tried too, man, and it's tough. And bass distortion, bass gain is just like such a subtle art. It's just really subtle art, man, because you're trying to make a low-end instrument sit in the mix just right. You don't want it to take up the guitar territory. You know, you don't want to, like, infringe on that, but you want it to be full. So usually a lot of those pedals have to have some sort of, like, mix knob to...
I just use it really subtly and try to get rid of that mid from, like, 800 to 2K, where everything else is distorted, but where, you know, I'll notch those off in between that register. So it doesn't have that big boxy distorted sound. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you still have the whole bass distorted, but you don't want that upper mid. You want the bass to still come out, but you can take it. That's what I do. I just notch filters out.
Yeah.
In fact, Ashdale made a preamp that had full parametric on it. And that's, I use that for a couple of things. But I mean, I'm still back to my, I'm just using rack mount stuff now instead of, it's just crazy. Everybody went pedal, you know, and now they've come out with the rack mount, you know, and they sent me like an RBI preamp and then the same pedal I've been using for years, the Sans amp, it's all over the Pantera records and everything I've ever done. Put into a rack mount and we found it works better in the studio now live. I don't know, you know?
Yeah.
But now I've got the pedals that's exactly what's in the rack mount. So they make really insane stuff.
They sure do. I want to cover the guitar picks thing again, cause we haven't talked about it this round.
Sure.
Just like back in the day, can you give us some insight as to, when you started using a guitar pick and what kind of guitar picks you remember you used in the beginning. And then I know you're on like Tortex. So you've been on Tortex tries for a long time as a bass player, but you know, I know you're also playing a lot of guitar.
But I use all kinds of stuff. So like if there's I have made from like different people, some guys down in Florida that do a really good job. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, the thing with MXR, if you're not constantly with those guys, just constantly ordering, I don't know who to go to. I don't know if Scott, if Uchida is still there.
No.
You know, I just called Jimmy.
Jimmy's the one. Yeah.
So, you know, I'll say, dude, I need, you know, some new ones. And I've got just bags full, you know, with different logos on there. And, I mean, I don't need to place another order until I go down the road. Right.
So, sure.
You know, I just use what I use till I'm out.
Yeah.
And I probably, you know, you guys would give me 12,000 a year. I mean, dude, you're not going to do 12,000 picks. Give me a break,
That's why you got to throw handfuls at them at the crowd, you know.
Yeah, you're right. But try to get rid of them. It's been a while since I've been on the stage, you know.
Yeah.
Properly, I miss that. So
maybe we can make some for your album release, and so you can send them into the special packages or something like that.
That's what I want, like the tens and all that stuff.
Yeah. Why don't we do that?
Yeah.
Let's
do that.
Yeah, I'm into that because that would be cool to get your artwork and kind of everything lined up. And
I'll send you that.
Yeah. Jimmy will be stoked to help out. He loves you. So
how's he doing, by the way?
He's really good, man. He's, you know, he's been, you know, weathering this whole thing with the business, and you know, but he's a proud dad and husband and raising a little boy. His boy's name is Max, you know, so he's got a little guy. I think Max must be like six or seven, maybe eight, nine. I don't know. I can't remember.
Really?
Yeah.
Last time I saw Jimmy was 2017.
Okay.
In Germany.
Warwick stuff?
He was still batshit crazy.
He's a wild card.
You gotta slow down, bro.
Yeah, he's chill. He's chill these days. He's not a crazy man right now. Yeah. He hasn't been crazy for a while.
Like, you know,
when he gets around Hans, man, he gets around Hans. Anybody gets around Hans. It's
Anybody
hard to let
Hans, it's over.
It's over, dude. Yeah. You're partying. That's like what's going on.
But I never did with Hans. You know,
Good for you. Good.
I never got around that. I don't think he never let me in close. I mean, he got me real close, like, you know, where I'm sitting at the table, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
But I never got into that back room.
Good for you.
even though I did get in the back room, I just didn't partake. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah.
Hans is nuts, dude.
Man, he's a character, dude.
This cat, he's up at 4 o'clock in the morning. You got to remember. He goes to bed at 8 at night, you know.
Wow.
But when it's time to have a blowout, you better step aside. I remember we had gone to, I'll tell you a story about Hans. We went to NAMM and we went to a major distributor. So we get distribution and he took me with him and he missed his points by maybe a point and a half for distribution and was so mad. He goes, come on, get your stuff, get in the car. I'm like, man, I gotta go sign some stuff over here, you know, Ernie Ball. You know? He's like, get in the car, we're going to the showroom. And so he gets to the place and he goes and they have it was a separate room just for booze that they would keep when they had parties and shit. And he pulled out just about every damn near bottle he could pull out of that fucking thing. And Wolf showed up from Except.
Oh, yeah.
And then they got crazy and started talking German. I've had to split.
It's like, yeah, what can you add to that?
This is like 3 p.m. You know, I was like, man, I've got to go sign. So I'll get you over here safely. And then from there you can. But he's always, man, Hans is always, I had the most respect for him as a person. His stuff's just too high priced.
Yeah.
To sell. I mean, he makes great stuff, but it just does. He's got the capital to do it. I mean, Jesus Christ, he owns all the turbines down in the, you know, all of, you know, all the bottom of Germany, you know? So he runs power for about a quarter of Germany. That's where he makes, you know,
I didn't know that.
The capital to do all this. So I just wish, I wish the prices would have been at a point where they were cool, but that's just the way the Germans do stuff, you know.
He makes a good market
over there, but over here you can't. It's just too pricey what they are.
He makes some really great stuff for Devin Townsend. I mean, I love his
guitars.
He made
really great stuff for me.
Yeah, it's just like, but it's really tough to, I mean, he's got to make an import line or something to make it work if, you know, because otherwise, like, the guitars he makes for him, I know.
Well, he was going to have distribution starting in August, you know, and with the pandemic, it shut everybody down.
Oh, okay.
Chris, take a quick break.
Yeah.
Quick break.
You got it.
Let me get some coffee.
Okay.
Chris, still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right, sorry. We got you wrong. I got the damn headphone there. I'm talking to the guy on the other line, taking a small break. I Had to get a copy. Cafe.
Makes sense to me, man.
How'd your friend Moon?
Moon's great. Like she said that you guys talked a little bit or back and forth on email. I'm actually drinking her tea right now. I don't know if you know, she has a couple different teas out with a brand out of, I don't know if they're in Taos, but they might be in Taos or something, like they're called Teography.
Does she have a place up there or something?
Yeah, she got a place in Taos, I think. It's like not her place. She just has a place she likes to go sometimes.
Right.
And, but she makes this really, really great tea with her partner at Teography. It's a, her favorite kind of tea is Earl Grey. And she makes an Earl Grey with rose petals and
with milk.
Yeah, she makes the moon milk style. So she does like, I think there's orange peels and like rose petals in her Earl Grey. It's just so good. So
yeah, she was trying to get me on some meeting for the SWGC or whatever.
Oh yeah.
To get rid of the Democrat thing, and I said I'd love to. I had something else. I was smoking a turkey ball or something, or smoking some ribs or something like that. Takes a whole day. Come on, man! This old coffee machine takes forever. Sure.
No hurry.
There we go. All right, sorry, man. I just got caught in the mouth so bad I couldn't stand it. You have to edit all
this. No problem.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to start. Management called and they want me to start interviewing, doing kind of what you're doing. Not a podcast. They're not calling it a podcast. They're calling it something else. It's going to be on Venmo or whatever it is.
Oh, Vimeo, yeah.
Vimeo.
Yeah.
And so we're going to record all that stuff just kind of like we are now.
Sure.
And I've got like Dave Cobb and some of the Nashville cats and the guy that went in with Jimmy Iovine and Dre and did the beats. He works for company. I got a ton of people. Rich Faulkner, I just called and so anyway, it's going to be just kind of one of those kind of talk shows, and I'll have to get my shit together like you just did.
Yeah, that's cool. That'll be fun.
Give me something to do. Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's something. It's like I didn't really see myself as doing this necessarily, but it was actually when Moon and I went to go see Tool when they were finishing up this last record that she was like watching me and Adam talk about guitar picks, and then all the guitar techs started chiming in. They're like, you know what? I used to use these guitar picks and, you know, this stuff, you know, and so-and-so used these for a while and until he switched over, and just the nerdy part of that. She's like, oh, maybe maybe you should just hang out and talk to people about guitar picks and gear and see what happens. You got a lot of friends. I'm like, that's true. I'll give it a shot. You know,
I was saying, you know, they at first they go, we just, you know, I do Zoom meetings with them three or four times a week. So, they go, we like the look of what you have just right there, you know? So I don't need to put a mic up or anything like that. I think the audio will be good enough, you know? And we just do it like this.
Yeah, it usually is.
Or I'll find a stand or something like that. I can probably prop this thing up so you can see me where it's sitting up, you know?
Sure.
But anyway, they like what they're seeing, and we're just going to call it Smoke on This Sessions with Rex Brown.
Oh, that's awesome. That's perfect.
Yeah, just talking about shit.
You know, I was I had a little short time. I got to hang out with Terry Date a little bit when I was living up in Seattle, and I can't remember all the details, but he told me a story about when you guys were completing the Trendkill sessions, and he said that I was wondering if you could confirm any of this or not, but he said something about how he had to take off and go do vocals with Phil in New Orleans, something.
He's gonna go to Trent.
What's that?
Yeah, go ahead. He just rent a car.
Oh. Yeah, him and Phil went to Trent Reznor's studio, I guess, to do vocals. And he told
Trent had a cool place down there.
Did he?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was like, he said he told his intern or somebody that was there, like, to stay back, stay there in Texas with Dime and Vinny and you, and to, like, make sure that they, you know, had a little schedule of, like punch-ins or whatever to do or something like that. But he told him, he said, man, whatever you do, if Dime asks you to drink, like don't get caught not drinking your shot. Like, if he offers you, don't get caught, because it'll be 10 times worse if you do. And he said – said when he came back, the dude was tied to the chair, or like duct taped to a chair, and they were like burning his, or shaving his head or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you remember this at all?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We duct taped him to a chair immediately. I think he stayed in that chair for about 2 or 3 days and just literally kind of funneled whiskey down his neck.
Oh, my God.
No, it wasn't that bad, but I do remember that very fondly. Why number one that Terry would leave his assistant with us, I have no idea. We could look, Vinny was so good, he punched in all the Don solos, you know. Mm-hmm. And if Don needed me there, he'd just call and say, man, I'm doing solos tonight. I'm not, you know, he'd kind of say, well, I don't know, I need you there, you know.
Yeah, like
sometimes he wouldn't, you know, he'd have it all mapped out, but like. I remember some of the times that like Don would like he would go through and usually play about 3 different passes, you know. Mm. And the first time was always the charm, especially like on Planet Caravan. Oh. And he wanted to fix that, and I'm like, dude, you're out of your mind. You know, these guitar players think they just punch in and punch you. Dude, it takes forever. That's the problem I had on the first record. And this guy just thought he could do it better every time, and it got worse and worse every time he did it. When you play from your heart, play from your soul, that's when the real, you know, the real stuff comes out. So it was, with Don is always the first take. I mean, unless you wanted to map out a full, you know, depending on what track it was. And that had a lot to do with, sometimes I would do the arrangements underneath the solos and stuff like that. So he might help to kind of bridge and where we were going to go. You know,
sure.
So
you guys got into all kinds of stuff, sounds like.
Well, we did. We got into all kinds of crazy shit, but at the same time we worked, our work ethic was bar none. You know, there was no way we were getting behind that board if we were shit faced, you know.
Right.
Because 9 times out of 10 we would erase it the next day, you know.
Really?
So we just knew that once it was, you know, Vinny's party time, that, you know, everybody, it was done for the night. And that was usually around 11, last call.
So you guys would be pretty straight laced for the recording part of it. And then party absolutely. Afterwards. Yeah. Yeah.
And we, you know, we would usually start 1 o'clock in the afternoon sometimes or 2 or 3, but when we got in the studio, man, it was such magic. It just poured out of us, you know. I don't know how it happened. It just, some days we'd kind of stump on it but at least try to just keep digging at it till we found something that would be at least be a skeleton so we can come in the next day. And then, you know, sleep does wonders for you, you know. Mm-hmm. You'll have that riff in your head and go, well, what about if we went to this chord, and that makes the whole freaking thing, you know. When we were under the gun, it made it worse for us to work, because we always felt the pressure, you know. Like anytime when the recording light was on, that was no big deal. When like a television camera was on, I used to always freak out. I don't know why. Just that inhibition of the red lights on, you know, somebody's watching. Now I don't give a fuck. But back then I was just I was apprehensive to it. You know, say we were supposed to do this soundtrack and had 2 days to do it. It somehow that would always we had to be done by this certain time, would always stump us. When we could get work done, if we didn't know there was any deadline, we could get done really, really quick, you know.
Mm.
Just because the magic was there.
Can you speak to like what happened between Cowboys and Vulgar? Like, as the band, as that shifted, like obviously Phil's approach shifted, but like the band kind of seemed to make a choice too, like over as a total, to shift from one kind of variation of what you guys could do to another.
the first thing when the record came out, we went immediately on tour with Suicidal and Exodus. Mm. And I say Suicidal because I put them first because without Mike Muir, I don't think, and going on that tour is such a, early stage of our career on the national stage. Watching him on stage every night was ferocious. Mm-hmm. And I think Phil really paid very, very close attention to that. In fact, I've even pulled Mike aside a couple of dime bashes ago in the same room. And I said, man, I just want to tell you, thank you, for having us on that tour, because if not, we went from playing, 3,000 seats a night to playing to 9 people a night, on our own. And, but the word of mouth just kept spreading and everything else. So I guess where I'm going with that is that we had played 338 dates on that touring cycle for Cowboys, came back, had exactly 3 weeks off, and then went in the studio. And a lot of that stuff that we had from Vulgar was stuff that we had off soundcheck. And you remember that we always had a camera rolling, so we always had a backup, and those tapes would be labeled and they'd be put aside in a different part of the camera bag. And then Don could go back and listen to what we did at soundcheck. But Vulgar it was such a, it came so easily that, we would work during the day writing the tracks and the Phil would come to sing at night. So we had that record done probably in 2 weeks. Wow. And then we had to, it takes a lot of time for prep to get the studio going and everything else. But, we were from playing 338 days. It's just like from Van Halen going for number one, number two. They were, like I said, can't get off of YouTube watching Eddie and them. And that's exactly what they did. Even though they put a couple of covers, I think there was a couple of covers on too. I can't remember which ones. It was just, when you're hot, you got to get it and catch it on tape. And it was just from those experiences that we had learned and traveling to different places. And of course, we went on tour with Judas Priest that year for 3 months in a fucking foreign land, two bands on a bus, double decker, dude, it sucked.
Wow.
It was $15 a day to live on over there was just fucking hell, man. And it was back before the Euro. So you had, we had shrapnel, that's what we call it. And pockets full of this shit. And you didn't know if you
different countries money
exchange it or yeah.
Was that part of when you guys did the Moscow? The big Moscow?
We were just finishing. We thought we'd had the record finished, and then Primal Concrete Sledge came in. Was that the first record?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was on Cowboys. Yeah.
It was on Cowboys. So we got a call in the middle. Okay, so we got off in like March or April when the studio, maybe it's more into the summertime. And then we got a call and that happened in September. So we had to load all the gear that we had and get it to the airport for Rocket Cargo to pick it up, to put it onto a huge carrier. I mean, dude, there's like 3 or 4 different places that this gear had to go past to get into Russia.
Wow.
So all the gear was taken down from the studio. We didn't have hardly anything left. So I think a lot of it was just kind of overdubs on small amps. And then we got there about 4 days earlier to Moscow and got to see the whole fucking coup go down.
Wow.
It was insane, man. And it just, I remember we flew in and it was just like a dim light bulb. There was no neon signs. Now you go into it, it looks like Vegas. Really? But it was all did like 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning, you know, people stand in line. And I asked the interpreter, I said, what are they standing in line for? She said, they're standing in line for bread.
Oh man,
this is the old, you know, changing guards. So that concert was all about the people, you know. It's a free show in the middle of of this airfield. And man, I mean, still going back and looking at it now with a wide camera view, we couldn't even, you know, the barricade was 40, 50 feet out, you know, because of the cameras and everything else. So, we could only see, you can only see about 100 yards in clear view. And I mean, it was overcast when we went on. But it was such a, you know, to be a part of such something so huge, you know, and we went on to play a lot of large events of 250, you know, 300,000, but never something that magnitude. There was well over, I mean, you couldn't see as many people, but they all had flags from different countries. And the border was open, you know, and it was free. They said, it was crazy. I didn't go too far into the depths of that crowd, you know. Mm-hmm. There's just too many cops. I mean, just the military was just ruthless.
I can imagine. Horrible.
11 people died, you know.
Whoa. At that concert.
Yeah. So, just insane, you know. I think the day we got there is when they shot the cannon through the fucking embassy or whatever it was. And we were staying at one of the only American hotels there, real nice, for Moscow. Mm-hmm. But it was really hard to kind of get used to, the food, you know. I remember they took us out to a place and it was all, borscht, you know, and, so everybody's ladling these big things. And I think I looked at Phil and either him or Dime just ordered a fucking case of Carlsberg, you know, that was on the menu. And that was our dinner and bread. Yeah. Oof. We didn't dig the borscht too much.
Yeah.
You know, our manager was furious at us, you know, you got to experience the culture.
Right.
Well, we never made you pay for a, you know, case of Carlsberg before. How's that?
Now you get to do that. What would you say are a couple of the highlights for you, you know, in your career? This, you know, I mean, you've got such a long, wide, you know, do you have anything that pops out when you think back, you're like, oh man, I mean, cause Moscow must be some kind of highlight because of that. And then
I'll put it in top three. You know, opening for Kiss was another one. Opening for Black Sabbath for 16 months is another one. In the top three, you know, playing so many times with Metallica between both bands was insane. Mm. You know, to a lot of people down in South America. Going to Japan the first time, you know,
really
up there, you know, even though we were playing smaller venues, it was still you know, we had full production, everything else, but going to Japan for the first time was just a complete culture shock. I don't know, man, it's really hard. I had so many good times just going up the Midwest. That was our place. I mean, we just go up there and just clean house, and that's really where we got a lot of our following, you know. We went from playing clubs and playing clubs to going, you know, after we had sat on Volga for six months until we got the Skid Row tour. So we had this record, we were playing it for everybody, and everybody's just like, this is like the next whatever, you know. Because Metallica had put out the Black album, and so there was no anything close to being heavy.
Right.
That was pretty much a rock and roll record for them, even though, you know, it's Metallica. They still have their flair to it. At the time, a lot of people felt let down, and we just slipped through that crack. You know, we had the record to do it with. And, you know, Phil was against the whole Skid Row thing, I think, from the very first. I said, dude, just think if we go and kick their ass every night, all you got to do is just tell them to come with us. You know, yeah. We can make them our fans. And we did every fucking night.
I bet you
every night, you know.
I mean, and looking from back
from there, we went straight into amphitheaters. You know, it was right. It was like insane. You know, before the Skid Row thing, we were playing to, you know, average of 50 to 100 people a night. You know, but they had the balls to fucking do that for us, and that was very important.
So they kind of helped break you guys in that way, right?
And it was all through the music. It wasn't any kind of, you know, side deal. We had to pay a lot of money to get on the tour. There was a lot of good being at the right place at the right times, had a lot to do with it. And then being in the wrong places at the wrong times had a lot to do with it too. So as you go on through your career, I mean, this music business, nobody lasts hardly that long at all. I mean, there's hardly any bands that have withstood this kind of torture we put ourselves through for that long, you know?
Yeah, you're lucky if you get 15 minutes, but you guys seem to get like 30.
Oh, my God. And it's still going.
Yeah.
It's still happening. So there's a lot to improve upon, all that, you know, with a different way that some of these new fans can be, let's say, you know, there's tons of fans that out there that don't know still, you know, and you have that 13 to 24 that we age bracket that we try to go for every year. Mm-hmm. And it seems to work, you know, either from dad or it's still a grassroots movement. It's insane. We're still selling is like we did back in 2001 when the band finished last note.
It's wow.
Nuts.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. I mean, I believe it because, I mean, I watch the socials and I see how ravenous the fans are.
If not, it's gotten bigger.
Yeah, it's definitely bigger.
Because of poor Dime, you know, and then now Benny, just a broken heart, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Or not knowing that he had, you know, his cholesterol was through the roof. And he was trying to help, you know, went to doctors and all that kind of stuff. And I just can't believe those guys are gone. But I've got to keep doing what I'm doing. And that's all there is to it. And I love it or hate it, I'm sticking around for a while.
I'm glad. I'm glad that you're here, man. I know it can't be easy to be marching on past the time when your brothers are gone. But the good news is that so many remember them and so many, you know, hold their memory in high regard and still kind of keep the spirit of both Vinny and Dime alive, you know, through that.
Yeah. It's crazy. You know, the myth is bigger than the actual reality of it all, you know?
Sure.
So I just kind of go with the flow, you know. You have to. If I was trying to point out all the discrepancies and everything else, I think that'd be a losing battle.
Yeah,
you know, so you remember the good times, celebrate life, and do what you got to do. You know, like I said, it's a lot of things happen in this life for reasons that we have no control over, and that's just the way it is. You know, like this situation that we're in now.
Yeah.
We have zero control other than wearing a fucking mask. And that's all that we can do. Without getting into any of that we got into before.
I know, right?
that's all I'm going to say.
Well, let's just vote. Let's just vote.
And you got to vote. Anybody that doesn't vote doesn't have a right to speak up. That's my opinion.
Yeah, we got to vote.
You don't have a right.
We got to come out in masses and
no bitching at the end of it. As long as you vote for either party, you're good
to go.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. At least you're exercising your right, your civil right. It's your civic duty, you know, and at some point,
hopefully we can all come together and make this dream of this democracy that is almost 300 years old, you know, make it a better place for everyone, you know. This is the way I kind of look at it. It's just common sense in my book. So
yeah,
there you have it. Vote.
Yeah.
Wear a mask. Do what you got to do. Keep the neighbors safe.
That's right. You listening to much music lately? What are you jamming?
I was just telling my buddy, me and Richie Faulkner met him in Nashville, and he's just such a cool dude, man.
What a badass
guitar player.
Oh my god.
You talk about badass, dude.
Dude, beyond.
We met each other and they came down to the studio when I was working a little, what was I working on? Towards the end of what we were doing, and we needed a night off, and Richie came down, and he brought this 55 hardtail that he had just bought that day at Carter's, where I do all my shopping. And Carter's is the coolest vintage guitar store in the
so
planet.
Cool.
They're just the nicest people in the world. And so he comes down, and I had this I've got a whole nother record of just like cover tunes that I did just for fun, just to, you know, keep the chops up.
Sure.
And I had him play on Bitch by the Stones.
Nice.
And turned out just amazing, man. And like, there were people around, they were partying and shit like that. I was just like, can we, Caleb, shut the door, you know, and let's just let him do what he needs to do. He goes, man, it's good. Just let him play it. I'm like, geez. All right. So we got him on tape, and he's a shredder, man. Just incredible.
He's blown me away. We had him out at the EMG studios too, back when we were doing the EMG TV
stuff. I've seen those sessions.
Yeah.
They're nuts.
I knew he was good, but I didn't know how good he was until he showed up for that. Like when he showed up for the first one and it broke out the Les Paul, we put the 5766 set in it, and he just blew all of our minds, all of our expectations. We're just like, who is this guy? Like he's
playing Les Paul too, of all things.
That's right. Right. And a Les Paul isn't really a shred guitar, right? I mean, it's like you can shred it. Obviously Zach Wild, all these people,
there's only a few guys these days that can really shred. And that, it's Richie. And who's that other guy that plays with Whitesnake? What's his name?
Reb Beach
he's been around LA for fucking years.
The guy that was
blonde hair,
Sykes.
No,
LA
boy, been around, played with everybody.
Doug Aldrich. Sorry, yeah, Aldrich.
He can shred. You know, those two are kind of alike in the shredding department.
Yeah.
Well, you got to get real clean when you get up there, and you know, you really got to. Your hands have to be strong. You know, when you're fretting up around that 12th fret and you're getting it, you know, because it's real easy for any ghost notes to pop out, you know. It's almost a palm mute in a way, you know.
Yeah.
A real light palm mute when you're going that incredibly fast. Kind of like Zach, you know.
Yeah.
Zach's a beast all into his own. So.
Oh, man. He's his own genre, you know.
Oh, my God. He's got it. He's so hysterical, man. I need to call him.
Yeah, you should. I need to get him out here on the podcast too, because he and I done some picks and all that stuff. He's just so, he's got great stories too. I like his whole demeanor is just larger than life. And I can see why him and Dime like got on well too, because they both had kind of like,
they're both maniacs.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And which you said, you say that you're listening
Zach's
to.
That's been a really good. Well, okay. Let me, I've been listening to more songwriters these days.
Yeah.
And something that just kind of fell upon was Jason Isbell, another great guitar player.
Oh, he's awesome.
And he's also just an incredible, incredible songwriter. I just think that I don't know, man. I heard this song the other day that's just got me choked up. It's called Only Children by him. Just brilliant, man. I mean, it's like Dylan-esque, you know, in a weird way to me. Mm-hmm. He does a lot of stuff with Crosby, which got a lot of shit. And saw his little post. He could have said something a little nicer, even though I'm a total fucking David Crosby fan.
Sure.
You know, this little reaction in Twitter could have been just don't reply.
Right. You know? Right.
It's so easy to get on that thing and just shoot your mouth off. But anyway, no, Isbell is just one of those really talented guys. You know, just and I like that. I've always been one of those cats, and you know, especially as we get older, we kind of, you know, my ears are fried, you know, from listening to metal and playing metal for all these years.
Sure.
I've always liked a really good song, man, regardless of what genre it is, you know. I think genres are way too, it's just music, man. It's not a, you know, it's not a pissing contest. You got a better song than one of Jason Isbell's, good luck, I want to hear it, you know.
Yeah.
Turn me on. But that's just what I, you know, have been listening to lately. Also this band called Church of the Cosmic Skull. You have to hear these cats. Insane. Really, really just mind-boggling killer.
Okay. Church of the Cosmic Skull. I like the name,
it's,
man.
It's dude, it's like this, it's like how can I say Black Sabbath meets ABBA, but it's not even Black Sabbath. It's like, it's kind of a throwback, but it's not. I can't put my hand on it.
Okay.
But it's, dude, you just have to, it's just like, it's like a little bitty cult, man. It's really cool. They do it all on their own. They don't want a record company. I've talked to two of the guys over in England. Just some really, you just got to check it out. I can't explain.
Okay. Yeah, I'll rock it. I'll check it out. I'll turn it up loud. See what it's got for me. I dig that.
Well, we about done, buddy. My stomach's gurgling.
Yeah, man, I'm hungry. I need to go eat. Thank you so much for your time, Rex. Man, it's always a pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for everything throughout the years and just being a good friend to me. And
we'll stay in touch.
Yeah.
Like we always do.
Yeah, we'll talk more about guitar stuff here soon. I got more questions for you. So,
all right, buddy.
All right, have a great day. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Peace, everybody.
Yeah.
Love one another. That's all you got to do. Bye-bye.
Love you, Rex. Take care.
Love you.
Bye-bye.